Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a very snowy day here in Maine, but I think the rest of the country. What's it like there in New York, Eric? It's snowing
it
there?
It is. I'm looking out my office window right now, and we have a lovely mixture of, I guess you would call it crud. It's crud. Kind of rain, kind of snow, but not nice at all.
No, this is a foot of snow that we're in. I was afraid our show was going to get canceled today because of the power. I didn't know if it was flickering earlier. But anyway, so this is the Best Ever You show, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Hamilton. And with me today, we have Eric Chesson. And April is Autism Awareness Month, and we're kicking that off with Eric. So, Eric, welcome to the show. And
Thank you.
For those following along with us on the computer, which we have a lot of people who do, you can look at his website while we're talking. His website is autismfitness.com. So what is autism fitness?
Good question. And that's the one that I probably get the most. I'll tell people, and people will invariably ask, oh, what do you do? And I say, well, I run autism fitness. And they say, wow, that's cool. And I say, wait, hold on, because there's a whole story behind it. I was very into fitness for a long time, since probably around 17, 18 years old. I was the backstory to that was I was an overweight kid. I got into weightlifting. It completely changed my life, not only from a physical health perspective, but also my outlook on life, socialization, self-esteem. So I took that into working with the special needs population, in particular the autism population. And the background of autism fitness, or how that got started, was I was in a general psychology master's program, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do career-wise, knew I loved fitness, knew I loved working with kids, but I never thought that I would fuse the two together. But I had somebody in one of my classes who was working with teenagers on the autism spectrum at the time, and she asked me if I'd be interested in implementing some fitness programs. I started doing it, found that nobody else had really done anything in that field, and kind of combining those two areas. And so that was the beginning of autism fitness, and that was about 10 years ago. So since then, I tell people what I am, if nothing else, is a bridge between the best that the fitness community has to offer, the best methodologies, the best programs, and on the other side, you have the special needs and the autism community that desperately need fitness programs and really good adaptive PE programs. They just don't, for the most part, have the technical information. So I get to introduce the two on a constant basis, and it always provides new challenges and a lot of excitement for me.
Now, as we were talking, I don't know much about autism. I'm admitting that. What, for someone listening, what is autism in a, you know, briefly?
Sure.
And how do you reach children with autism for fitness?
Well, autism is a collection of different neurological symptoms and behavioral issues, which ultimately the hallmark, if you will, of autism is a difficulty connecting ideas or contingencies, difficulty socializing and self-expressing and interacting with people. Now, individuals on the autism spectrum often do want to communicate and connect with people. They just have a very, very difficult time doing it. And autism is referred to as a spectrum disorder because you have individuals who are very low functioning from a cognitive, a physical, and a behavioral perspective. And then you have individuals who are very high functioning, whom you could have a conversation with for 3 hours and not necessarily pick up on it. So there's a wide range of abilities, but at the center, you have this difficulty connecting to people, connecting to concepts, and really making sense out of daily life and the things that go on in the world.
Mm-hmm. And
then in terms of go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I was going to ask you something, but you go, keep going.
Okay. In terms of reaching individuals on the autism spectrum with fitness, what I've found, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, but I developed something called the PAC profile, because what I saw was a lot of people trying to put square pegs in round holes. They had a fitness program, or they had a sport, or they had some type of physical activity, and they didn't know how to adapt it for this population, because you can't just look at the physical functioning. And a lot of individuals on the autism spectrum have gross motor deficits and movement issues. This has all been found in research and in the anecdotal evidence also, that children and young adults on the spectrum have a lot of movement issues. They have a lot of kinesthetic issues. So not only do you have to consider the physical issues, but also their adaptive issues. Are they motivated to do this? Do they want to perform this physical activity? If not, how do we create an environment where they do want to participate? And thirdly, the cognitive perspective. Sometimes a situation or an activity is way too challenging for an individual on the spectrum, so you have to figure out how best do they learn. Are they more of a visual learner? Are they more of an auditory learner? Are they more of a kinesthetic learner? And once you piece those together, then you can really start developing programs, not around the program that you already have, but around the individual. And that's how it's been successful through my programs with Autism Fitness.
Mm-hmm. And what is a PAC profile?
The PAC profile, PAC stands for physical, adaptive, and cognitive. And those are the three variables or the three abilities that I've found are the most critical in developing fitness programs for individuals on the spectrum, because I would have parents or professionals email me or call me asking, what kind of program would you put together for a 12-year-old or a 7-year-old or a 17-year-old? And invariably, I'd say, well, I need a little bit more information than that. But then I thought, what information do I really need? And what information would anybody else need to create a good program? Because I know we're not just looking at their physical functioning. For example, if I have 8-year-old Mary, who physically is functioning pretty well in terms of going through the movement screen portion of the PAC profile. She can do the jumps, she can do the bear walk, she can do the medicine ball throw, she can do all of this stuff independently, but adaptively, she's not really motivated to participate, then we're going to have to figure out what's going to be motivating for her to stay in this situation, to keep interacting and to keep doing the movement activities for longer than 20 seconds or 30 seconds at a time. And then from the cognitive perspective, let's suppose that I give her the direction, pick up the ball, hold it over your head, and walk across the room. That direction might be too challenging for her. There may be too much information. She may be able physically to do all those things, but when I give her that direction verbally, she can't put it together. But then what if I demonstrate it for her and then she gets it? So we're not just looking at, you know, it's not intelligent versus non-intelligent. It's not smart versus stupid. It's how do people learn best? I know for me, in my history, and I was just writing about this in a new ebook that I'm writing about bike riding for the teaching children on the spectrum how to ride bikes. I mentioned that I was horrible with math all through elementary and middle school and high school. When I got to college, I took statistics, and it was applied statistics, and I did really well. I got an A, and I had never gotten an A in math. So was it that I all of a sudden got smart at 18 years old, or was it because it was taught in a way that I understood it? So that's kind of the perspective that I take on the cognitive ability. It's not just low versus high cognitive ability. It's what type of learner do we have? If they thrive and they really get it when we demonstrate the exercise for them, then that's the way we're going to teach it. It makes more sense rather than be frustrated telling them over and over and over, pick up the ball, pick up the ball, pick up the ball 50 times when I could just show them. And if they're a visual learner, then they're probably going to pick up on that.
Right. Now, if I have an autistic child, Do I have to come to you in New York to work with you, or do you fly all over the country, or do you have a center that people can go to? How does that part of it work?
I have a couple different ways that I operate here in the New York metro area. I do individual consultations, although with my schedule, is becoming a more limited part of my practice. I also do distance consultations, and I love doing it because I can provide video back and forth. So a parent will go through these different activities with their child. They'll send me the video online. I can evaluate it. I can ask some questions, and then I can send a video-based program back to them. And that's been a great way for parents who are all over the country. And then, of course, I also have my workshops that I present all around the country. And next year also we're looking at some international venues as well. So I do an entire workshop on the PAC profile as well, which is great for people because it's a lot of hands-on. I talk for about 20 minutes at a time, unlike here where I can just go on for quite some time. But it's very hands-on, and people come away with it from the feedback I've got with a really good working knowledge of how to provide fitness programs for the autism and the special needs population. So I think, and then of course they can purchase the PAC profile as well and use that as both an assessment and a programming template. And then on my blog, I have a lot of videos that people can check out for free of the different exercises that we use, because, you know, writing about exercises is one thing, but if you really want to understand it, I find that video or being there live are much better ways.
Yeah, and this is a very important part of anybody's life. You know, exercise is very important, and it's neat to recognize this, because it seems like a lot of people, a lot of parents with autism are focusing on the why. Why did this happen? What's causing this? Let me fix it with this. They're looking for a cure, which, you know, I don't blame them one bit, or, you know, a dietary change or something like this. But in the meantime, while you're looking for all of those things, this takes care of a person's heart, health, body, and so forth. Are you finding that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more, absolutely. And I think, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, my real challenge was convincing people that fitness and physical activity were important for this population. And I think a lot of that had to do with, and it still does to an extent, but a lot of that had to do with the public or the cultural perception of what exercise is. I met a lot of parents who said, well, my kid doesn't want to play sports, so they're really not active. And one, I think the most important or the most crucial point that people can take away from anything that I do or any of my presentations or anything that I write about is that sports are not the be-all, end-all of physical activity. Yeah. The way I describe it is everybody looks at sports as the top of the pyramid in terms of physical activity, when they're really a branch on a tree, and the roots and the trunk of that tree are general fitness and play. And you can develop those skills your entire life. I mean, I as an athlete continue to develop those skills, and you know, my friends and colleagues in fitness or who are active on a regular basis, that's what they're doing also. So I think the definition of athlete, and this is not this is certainly not my attempt at trying to make things PC, but I think the definition of athlete needs to be broadened beyond what people usually think, which is team sports. Because I'll tell you, kids who play just one sport, a lot of them get hurt, or even more of them just burn out and don't want to do it anymore. So if we're looking at things from a long-term perspective and we say, well, you know, I want little Lisa to be able to be physically active and healthy all through her life. If she just plays, you know, soccer until she's 12, 13, 14, maybe 15, and then stops, what does that do from a long-term perspective.
Yeah, when you're my age, when you're 42, are you going to really be out there, you know, playing soccer? Maybe, maybe not.
Right.
I know I'm not. But, you know, I view, you know, and these kids get older, too. And so, you know, I agree with you in that, you know, I'm looking at your website as I'm talking to you, and it looks like you're in sort of maybe a gym-type environment with cones, maybe jump ropes, something like that. And that's fitness. And I think I think you're trying to get people to recognize that even if you go outside and walk around your block, that's fitness.
Oh, sure. And it depends.
It might not mean you're, you know, perfectly muscled and toned and everything, but you're moving.
Well,
you
that's
have
the perception also.
Yeah.
And you have to be very careful of where the information is coming from. Is it coming from a magazine that's trying to sell you an idea of fitness, or is it coming from a knowledgeable professional who, you know, first and foremost wants people to be safe and healthy, and secondly, and from an aesthetic standpoint, I can understand that everybody wants to look good, and there's nothing wrong with that. Also, I want the kids that I work with to look good, and so their parents. That's also part of the teenagers that I work with on the spectrum. I want them to be able to interact with their peers. I want them to be accepted socially also, and being fit and having good posture and being able to carry yourself well, that's a huge part of social interaction. Can fitness help with that? Yes, absolutely.
Now, when you have when you're evaluating a child and putting together a fitness routine for them, how could you explain maybe to some of the parents listening how that how an example of how you might play off that child's strengths?
Sure. Well, we always want something that's motivating in that session. And I tell people with the PAC profile in terms of the assessment, an assessment can take 2 or 3 or 4 sessions because your first job is to make it a reinforcing and a positive situation for that individual. My first rule is you can't force fun. You can't tell somebody they're having a good time when they're not and expect them to turn around. You can have a kid who's tantruming on the floor and say, "Wait a minute, you're having fun." It's not really going to change their behavior much or change the situation for them. You have to set up the environment and set up the situation so that it's fun. If that means that we do one fitness activity and then they can go listen to their iPod or do something that's more reinforcing for them, then that's the way that we'll do it. And then in terms of their strengths, that's something that I want to figure out very quickly because we like or we tend to like things that we are good at more than things that we are not good at. So if I find that one of my athletes really enjoys and is really good at, say, doing our bear walks or doing some of our animal movements, but they're not as good or not as adept with medicine ball throws, then we will do a lot of those animal movements, and then maybe I'll throw in one or two of those medicine ball throws, and then we'll go right back to those animal movements. Because all throughout that session, and really from a long-term perspective, I want to build confidence. The things that they're not so great at, we can work on those. But if they're motivated and if they want to participate in one of those activities, then we can get them in the session for longer. Then we can build up to 10 minutes and then 15 minutes and 20 minutes. And I tell parents all the time, you don't have to start with a 35 or 40-minute fitness session. You can start with a 35 or 40-second fitness session and just build it up from there because we want to work around the needs of that individual rather than try to force the individual into what our plan is.
Right. Now, with this, I come across all sorts of things where they say cure autism and all this stuff. You're not saying that.
No.
Are you seeing – no, I see it very clearly.
No,
you're not promising to cure autism at all.
No, I mean –
When you work with a child, do you notice that I'm trying to word this right because I really don't know much about autism, so please correct me if I'm wrong.
Go right ahead.
When you work with a child, and let's say they're working with you, does any part of their autism go away or get better, or do they function more, anything like that?
Well, if we look at, let's say autism is a switchboard, and levels, and level 10 is the highest. If we're looking at social and cognitive functioning, and I'm being very broad because obviously there are different kinds of social functioning, different kind of cognitive, but if we're doing a general scale and we have social can go to 10 and cognitive can go to 10 and initiative or independent activity can go to 10, if I have an individual who's functioning at a 4 or a 5 at each of those levels, can we bring them up to a 6 or a 7 with fitness? Sure, in certain situations. And I'll give you an example. I work with young man. He's actually the teenager who's in all the videos on autismfitness.com. I've been working with him for, about 6 or 7 years now. He, in the past, when I first started working with him, when he would have a break, he would just kind of wander around the room, and that was fine. That's what he wanted to do. Now, when he has a break, he'll pick up the medicine ball, or he'll pick up the sand bell, which is a great piece of equipment that I use and promote. He'll pick it up, and he'll start playing catch with me. So right there, not only do we have him being motivated to engage in physical activity, but we also have a socialization component. Maybe if that generalizes into the school situation or with other peers, he'll pick up a ball and start initiating catch with another individual. The goal of fitness is to be able to perform activities not only in the fitness session, but beyond that also. That's why we want to go from general fitness to specific rather than the other way around. Playing soccer or playing baseball doesn't really carry over physically to too many other tasks.
Right.
You can't play baseball and get stronger in a squat or pressing something overhead, but you can get stronger in a squat or stronger in pressing, and it will enhance those sports skills. So we want to go from general to specific. And in terms of those deficits or some of the issues in autism, with autism fitness, I tell people that I only make two promises. Those two promises are, one, the kids and the young adults that I work with will start moving better, and number two, eventually, they will start enjoying movement. And I don't think I've failed on either of those just yet. It might happen one day, but to this point, I've been pretty successful.
Yeah, and with autism, you were saying that there's different spectrums. Now, if someone isn't functioning very well, how do you handle that? So, for example, if we have a parent, you know, who's listening right now and their child just isn't at that high-functioning level, is that a good fit for you as well? What do you do in that case?
Well, it depends which area you mean by functioning. I assume you mean from a behavioral perspective, and that's fine. A lot of the and I'm very fortunate, I feel, in my career also, because the first individuals on the spectrum that I was working that I had worked with were low functioning behaviorally. We're talking about a lot of aggression, self injury. I have my battle scars on my arms from being bitten. So I've dealt with very low functioning individuals from a behavioral standpoint and very high functioning individuals. The thing to take away and the point to remember is that we can always improve skills and always improve in performance. But we first have to take into account and do an assessment, what are the baseline skills? What are we starting with? From my perspective, as you know, an exercise physiologist and someone who's running a fitness program, okay, where are we functioning from a physical perspective? But then also look at the population. I also need to know a little bit about their motivation or their behavioral issues, if there are any. And then I need to know about their cognitive functioning as well. So even if they're low functioning in all three of those areas, what's cool is I can focus on, let's say, the adaptive portion, their motivation, their behavior. If every time in an extreme situation, and I'll preface this by saying also you definitely want a qualified behavior therapist or somebody else who's qualified to handle the situation to be involved if they're developing a behavioral protocol. But if I know that one of my athletes is going to be aggressive if the session goes on too long, then we're just going to do fitness for maybe 5 seconds, and then they get to do whatever they want within reason, whatever is reinforcing for them, and then maybe we'll come back to that later on. So we're going to scale it to their individual level of functioning. So what I do want to say is that there's hope, but that hope relies upon figuring out what are the functional abilities of that individual.
Excuse me. Yep. And, you know, I really like this because you're taking a complete approach to the person that's involved. And I do have one question. We only have a few more minutes to speak with you before Areva Martin joins us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look at any part of their nutrition and food to correspond to your fitness also with the children?
You know, I'll have the conversation. A lot of times everything is so overwhelming for parents. And, you know, there are a lot of feeding issues or nutritional issues involved. I am not a registered dietitian or nutritionist, but overall things can be simplified and made very easy. The problem is that kids get very used to eating, I call them edible things that are labeled food, very early on. And these aren't things that we as human beings crave naturally. You know, no child is born just craving goldfish crackers. I'm just using that as an example. Not that goldfish crackers are necessarily worse than anything else on the shelf.
But
when you grow up eating vegetables and eating good sources of protein and complex carbohydrates and healthy fats, then it becomes more of a lifestyle. And what I try to convince people of with autism fitness is that fitness is part of a lifestyle, which is why I love working with families that are very proactive and just want to get their kids involved in fitness on a regular basis. So the nutrition component can be, if you start out with the right components, then it can be relatively easy. If you start out with the wrong components, then it gets to be a little bit more of a challenge. But the same thing with fitness and movement also. If you start incorporating things slowly and just build up from the current level of ability, then you can be successful. And the small successes lead to the bigger successes. It doesn't have to be all at once.
Now, one more question. And I hope people do go to autismfitness.com and watch the videos. The videos are very helpful. And do they contact you if they want to purchase a PAC profile? Can they purchase right online?
Yeah, they can get it right
online. Okay, right on.
Quit on Autism Fitness. And then if anybody is interested in a consultation or just wants more information, they can email me, Eric, E-R-I-C, at autismfitness.com. All the information is on autismfitness.com, so they can just go there and check it out. And I also have my e-book is on sale this month as well.
Nice. Okay. Before I let you go, let me see. Areva, are you on the phone with us?
I am. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us. Eric, do you want to stay with us
Sure.
for the rest of the hour? Okay. Super. So our next guest is Areva Martin, and again, we're kicking off Autism Awareness Month with Areva Martin and Eric Chesson. And Areva is known to audiences across the country for her regular appearances on the Dr. Phil Show and the Balancing Act, and I've seen you on CBS, the CBS Early Show and Fox News. You've been everywhere. You're a lawyer. You're an attorney, and I think one of the biggest questions I have for you is, an attorney turned autism expert, why?
Wow, good question. You know, it starts with me at home. My journey in terms of working with families who have autism started because my own son, Marty, was diagnosed with autism when he was 2 years old. In my legal practice, I have been representing some families who had kids with various disabilities, not really autism, though. So I was familiar with some of the issues families face in terms of accessing services for special needs kids, but I hadn't done a lot of work around autism. And after my own son's diagnosis, of course, you know, I, like so many other parents, found myself in such desperate need of information and, you know, needing to learn how to navigate the various systems of care. And in working my way through that, you know, I realized that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of other parents who had some of the same questions and issues that I had. So my journey in terms of writing a book about autism, starting a nonprofit, and really becoming a spokesperson began at home with my son.
Yeah, and for those of you following along with us on the Internet, I would like to turn your attention, not away from the show, but in addition to Ariva's website, which is the Special Needs Network, and you can get to, I think it's specialneedsnetwork.net. Can you also do that .com and .org, or is it just .net?
You can do it specialneedsnetwork.org
okay.
or .net, but .org or .net works.
Yeah. Okay. And then also people can buy your book, which is called The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism. What does that mean to you to stand up for a child with autism? What do autistic children need? Go ahead. Sorry.
You know, I'm sorry. Children with autism, just like any child that has a disability or disorder, often they can't speak for themselves. You know, they cannot articulate their needs, their wants, and they need someone to be their voice. And the book, Everyday Advocate, is just that. It's about how do parents, how do caregivers, how do caretakers stand up for kids with autism and other special needs. And it gives you step-by-step guide to what that looks like. Everything from how do you determine what's the best educational placement, how do you find the right therapies, how do you find recreational programs. I know you were speaking to a guest earlier about, you know, athletics and getting kids involved in movement and different activities. You know, that's for a lot of parents, just identifying those resources can be challenging and overwhelming. So the book is my way of helping parents, you know, have that comprehensive step-by-step guide. And it's also filled with a lot of inspirational stories. In my journey, I've met just the most amazing, I do mean amazing parents, and I share some of the stories, people that I've represented in my law practice, families that I've had the honor and pleasure of meeting in my nonprofit, you know, families I've met as I've traveled the country speaking. So I tell some stories of how people all over this country are joining this movement of advocacy and really starting, you know, to change the way society looks at people who have disabilities, you know, how services are delivered in certain communities. And I'm just really, really excited about, you know, what I see happening today around autism versus when my son got his diagnosis about 7-8 years ago.
Right. And when you – just a real personal question – and the reason why I'm going to ask this is because before we went on air, in my Facebook, someone said, Elizabeth, I'm so glad you're doing this show today because I have a grandson that has autism. And there was a little bit more to it than that, but that was the general gist. And when you have a child and all of a sudden they're diagnosed with something like this, what is it? What do you do? What's your first reaction to parents out there who are getting this diagnosis for their child for the first time? What do you do?
You know, Elizabeth, one of the first things that many parents do is they panic, they weep, they grieve. There's a great sense of loss. You will hear the words devastation. You'll hear the word, you know, just emotional, overwrought people just feeling as if something has been taken away from them. You know, all of the dreams, the expectations, you know, they go into the birth of a child. You know, as parents, we start to plan even before that child is born. You know, we're picking out the colors for the nursery. We're thinking about preschool. We're thinking about elementary school. You know, if it's a boy, we're thinking about what sport are they going to play. And some of us are even thinking college, you know. You know, where are they going to go to college? Yeah. My husband and I had this debate. Is he going to go to Columbia where he went or University of Chicago where I went? You know, so we had this little, you know, friendly competition in our house about, you know, where was our son going to go to college? And, you know, was he going to play football or tennis like our daughters? Or, you know, so you're doing a lot of planning for kids.
Yeah, well, I'm a mom of four boys, so I completely get what you're saying.
Oh, okay. Well, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know that those topics start really early on.
Really early, yeah.
And then you get this diagnosis, and I think the most difficult part, and I say this all the time to families, is unlike diabetes or, you know, some conditions where we have a lot of information and we know how to treat it, you know, you can get an insulin shot, you can alter your diet, you can exercise more, you can take a pill. When you get the autism diagnosis, there's so much that we don't know about it. And we know it's a lifelong condition. We know there's no known cause or cure. So you're sitting in this doctor's office hearing this, and you have so many questions and there's so few answers. And I think that's what leads to the sense of just, you know, pain and grief because, you know, if you told me my kid had diabetes, they says, well, you know, Ms. Martin, there are several options. You know, you can, you know, treat with insulin or you can, you know, and they give you those. You know, you leave saying, wow, I'm really, you know, hurt by this. But hey, we got a treatment plan. When you leave the doctor's office with an autism diagnosis, you're like, what?
Yeah, I can imagine the what with that because, like you're saying, there's people really angry about autism, and there's people trying to find what the cause of it is, and all of this stuff. I was talking to Eric a little bit about that too, but the general. You know, the treatment of it isn't going to be to get angry. You're not going to be able to help somebody if you just get angry about it. Do you know what I mean? That's not going to anything. It's not going to do any good.
We're talking about humans and human emotions. And you know, I've been at conferences where, people are angry. They're mad.
Oh,
you know, why my child? Why is this happening? How come there's not more, research? How come there are not more dollars being allocated? How come we're not further along? You know, so you get a lot of that frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And some parents get stuck there.
Right.
They get stuck in those emotions, and they're immobilized by those emotions. But there are others, and I would say the majority, you know, have a period where they, you know, experience, you know, various emotions. And then they start to move from what I call that place of anguish to a place of advocacy. And that's really the beauty, you know, of the concept of advocacy is that you can see people who are at their weakest state all of a sudden, you know, feel empowered, feel confident. And, you know, they're out leading, you know, conferences. They're speaking at their schools. They're leading support groups. You know, they're comforting other parents. And they were like me when I started on my journey. I couldn't say the word autism. It brought up too many emotions. It just, I would weep. And here I am, this big, tough, strong, you know, litigator.
Lawyer, yeah.
Sending clients and trials and, you know, dealing with really tough, you know, opposing counsel and complex litigation matters. But, you know, when it's about your child, you know, all of that gets wiped away and, you know, your emotions can really, you know, take over. So, but I'm living proof, and I say this to all my parents. You know, you don't have to be a lawyer, you don't have to be a politician or a lobbyist, you don't have to have a bunch of, you know, alphabets behind your name to really become an effective advocate for your child.
Yeah. Now, you were saying you had girls. Do you have other children?
Yes, I have two daughters.
Yeah.
They are older. They're my older daughters, and my son is the youngest.
Okay. Now, when you have an autism diagnosis, how does it affect your family? And then I was going to go from there on to back to advocacy for a minute. I just really wanted to ask you that.
This ties into everything. Everything about this diagnosis ties into advocacy because one of the things I talk about in the book, The Everyday Advocate, is becoming an advocate even in your own family. You know, the diagnosis can either make your family stronger or it can completely tear it apart. And I've seen both situations. I've seen parents who become absolutely polarized. Dad feels like mom is spending too much time with the autistic child. Other siblings feel like there's too much attention placed on the child, that they are left out of the equation. They start acting out in school. They develop, you know, an adversarial relationship with the other child. They hate mom. I've seen that, and then I've seen the opposite where families band together and they say, this is our child, and whatever that condition is, we're going to face it as a family. We're all going to get in and support not just the child, but the siblings, the parents, and everyone involved. And I think which way your family responds has a lot to do with who the advocate is in the family and the actions taken very early on. And in the book, The Everyday Advocate, I give parents some strategies, some tips, some guides to how to introduce the concept, how to introduce, you know, the term autism, how to, you know, call your family together and talk about it, because the word doesn't tell you very much. Billy has been diagnosed with autism. Oh, wow, does that mean he's brilliant? Does that mean he's a math genius? Does that mean he's a great artist? You know, you get all kinds of
Yeah, you have no responses. Idea what it means exactly.
It doesn't tell you anything. So,
so
you know,
do you
I
go about...
Them,
go, oh,
ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask
you. You've got to unpack the term. You've got to unpack the
yes.
term.
Yes. That's where I was going to, what I was going to ask you is, how do you, as a mom with this diagnosis, then start to uncover what kind of, I don't know if this is the right word, but what kind of autism or how much autism or... You know, what I think you call it a spectrum of different, you know, as with any problem or anything, it could be really bad or it could be not so bad. How do you uncover what your child's capable of and help them be the best that they can be?
You know, that's a great question, Elizabeth, and that's a journey. It's not on day one. The doctor's not going to tell you, Billy has mild, moderate or severe autism. And to the extent they do tell you that, it's based on what they see at that moment.
Right.
So my child, I'll give you a perfect example. When my child was diagnosed, Marty, he wasn't speaking. So they could tell me this is, you know, a moderate to severe case because he has no language. But that doesn't mean that Marty will never speak, and it doesn't mean that Marty's case may become milder after he has interventions. And you hear lots of stories of parents who say their kid was, you know, just a wreck. They had, you know, these really negative behaviors. They had no language. And after, you know, some intervention, their child was talking. Their child was interacting with other peers. So the labels are really tricky, and they don't mean much all the time, and they definitely don't mean much at the same time. So as your child grows, as interventions occur, you know, the child's diagnosis or at least the label will change with that child. So that's, when I talk about unpacking that term when you're talking with family, that's why it's important, because if you just tell grandma and grandpa, little Billy has autism, and I just had this happen. I teach a class in my nonprofit. It's called PAM. It's a Parent Advocacy Mentor class. And we're on a mission to train 1,000 grassroots advocates in the county of Los Angeles. And we've done about 150 so far. So we're at the beginning of our journey, but we just started last year. But I had a grandmother and grandfather in my class last week, and granddad said, I'm in this class because my daughter brought my grandson over, and he has autism, and she went away for a weekend trip, and boy, did I have a weekend. And my wife left town, and the wife says when I got back, she said that her poor husband looked like he had been through a war zone, and her house was, because granddad had no tools. Granddad had no clue. But I applauded him, because after that weekend, he said, hey, I got to get control of this. I've got to learn something. So he enrolled in this 18-hour intensive weekend class because he wanted to be able to be better prepared and provide better support to his grandchild. But that was a classic example where the parents hadn't sat down with family, close family members who were going to be involved with the care of this child, and talked about what the autism meant for that little boy. So granddad said, I couldn't get him to eat. He didn't sleep at night. You know, everything I would give him, he would tear it up. You know, he didn't know what, he just had no clue about, you know, how to engage his little grandson. And he was at his wit's end by the time the weekend was over.
Oh, yeah, I believe it.
Quite horrific, in fact, he said. So, you know, you just can't tell someone, you know, a Marty or Billy or whatever, you know, the name is, has autism. You got to sit down, and particularly those folks who are close to you who are going to spend time with that child. Well, what does that mean?
Right. Yeah.
So that has to be discussed.
What I really love about speaking with you, I don't just like it, I really love it, is that your words are interchangeable. It could be autism or it could be fetal alcohol syndrome, for example. I mean, it could be anything. And your special needs network isn't just for autism. Is that correct? It's for...
Oh,
or
you
are. Just...
So thank you. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for bringing that out. And even the book, The Everyday Advocate, the paperback title is Standing Up for Your Child with Autism and Other Special Needs, because it really is about any child that needs extra help, you know,
yeah.
Whether there's cerebral palsy or, like you said, alcohol, you know, fetal syndrome or epilepsy or any condition that impacts a child's ability to learn or you know, use language or, you know, impacts their behaviors. And Special Needs Network is just that. It's an organization that caters to kids who have everything from autism to learning disabilities to ADHD, you know, to Down syndrome, to any number of conditions, because we understand that all of those kids need a little extra help, and the parents need extra help when, you know, navigating systems of care for those kids. So it's definitely not just about autism.
Yeah, and just a just a personal story. Our family, we have, it just depends, anywhere from 10 to 20 kids. there's 10, but we have all their friends and so forth. But my mom and dad and our family adopted a child at birth. It was the youngest of all of us. And when he was, I don't know, maybe like 2, he started beating his head against the wall of his crib. And my mom was like, something's wrong. And autism wasn't something people really spoke about back, you know, 25 years ago or anything like this.
Right.
But I think that's what they thought he might have had. But as it turns out, I mentioned fetal alcohol syndrome. We adopted a child with fetal alcohol syndrome. The one real key point that I think I can connect with here especially is, they said Justin, my brother, would never walk, he'd never talk, he was never going to function, he was never going to do this, that, or anything, tie his shoes. And we worked with him. And no, he's severely disabled, yes. But he can write, he writes beautiful poetry. He does amazing things because my parents have spent so much time with him. And The one part of this also is that I've noticed that people really pick on people with disabilities in our world. It makes me very sad to see. And my brother in particular was a victim of a violent crime 2 years ago. If you Google Justin Hamilton in Minnesota, you'll see that a lot of people have been convicted for what they did to him. Do you notice that at all with kids, and how do you protect your child from things like that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Unfortunately, we know that bullying is on the rise, whether are a special needs kid or just a typically developing kid. You know, we've heard so many horrific stories over the last year or two about, you know, kids who've committed suicide over being bullied, you know, kids who've been bullied on the internet, kids who've been beaten, who've been, you know, taunted at school. There's just so many horrible examples. And it's a big issue, and Special Needs Network is really tackling it. Again, in the book, The Everyday Advocate, I have a section addressing it because I think parents, again, no matter whether you have typical or, you know, kids that have some kind of disability, you need to be very, very sensitive to, you know, the rise of bullying and be able to provide some support. A couple of things that parents can do. One, you've got to be so involved at your kid's school. You have to know what's going on, who your, you know, kid's friends are, watch for changes in behavior. You know, if your child is, you know, I don't want to go to school anymore, if they're avoiding the bus, if they're avoiding certain activities at school, all of those might be signs that something is happening. Look for, you know, signs that clothes are torn, tattered, things are missing out of their backpack. You know, their lunch money is missing. And you've got to talk to your kids. You've got to be in regular communication. And if you notice any of those signs, changes in behavior, changes in their attire, you know, missing items, then you've got to get involved. And if the child isn't willing to talk, you've got to talk to the school, because usually somebody knows something. I mean, bullying rarely happens in total, you know, isolation. Usually there are other kids that know about it, or there's someone at that school. And I tell parents, have an absolute zero tolerance policy for bullying. And that means be prepared to report to your local police, your local child protective services, whatever it takes, because we know now from so many examples that bullying is not something to be taken lightly, and that, you know, parents have a responsibility, the other adults, be it schools, and I, in my law firm, I have cases that I represent families where parents are writing letters to principals and nothing was done.
Yeah.
That's not acceptable. That is not okay. And I tell these parents, you know, if you write a letter once and you don't get a response, call the police. You know, take elevator. Write a letter to the superintendent. You know, you don't want to be overly dramatic, but nor do you want to ignore something that could be, you know, result in serious physical or emotional harm to your child.
Yeah. Now, I know we're talking about autism, and we're talking about a lot of different things. Can we talk about you for just a minute? And
there's a lot
of people on here who our viewers, our listeners and viewers, love to know how you got to where you are. How did you get to be a lawyer? Is it something that you always wanted to do? I know I'm shifting gears dramatically, and we'll follow back up with your book and tell people to go to your website again. But just about you a little bit.
Well, I grew up in North St. Louis, and I went to the University of Chicago and on to Harvard Law School, and then I moved to the Los Angeles area. I worked, and this is like, you know, the 30-second soundbite of my life. I worked.
Yeah, but you went to Harvard.
Briefly.
I read that.
I went to Harvard Law School. Then I worked briefly for a corporate firm, so I worked for a Wall Street law firm. I then left and started my own practice. I've been in my own practice now for close to 20 years. It's one of the largest African-American-owned law firms in Southern California. We have a broad civil litigation practice, disability discrimination, employment, school, and other education-related matters that we represent a variety of clients in. And about 5 years ago, I started writing and speaking, and I've written two books, actually, and just really started looking very closely at this concept of advocacy and how important it was. You know, I just, like I said, saw so many families in need, so many families struggling to access information, that I wanted to share what I had learned. You know, I had fought the fought. I had, you know, been the battle with my son's school. I'd been the battle with, you know, various care providers over services for my son. And I knew how difficult it was. And I said, wow, if I'm having all of this trouble, and I'm a Harvard-trained lawyer, I own a law firm, you know, I was a community leader doing stuff in my community, I sat on boards, you know, I had what people would call a great deal of access. But despite that, I was really struggling. So I said, wow, if I'm having this, you know, I'm having this level of difficulty, what must, you know, a mom or dad that doesn't have this level of education, access, you know, et cetera, have? So, you know, I grew up in my North St. Louis area. I grew up in a housing project. I grew up very poor. I grew up with my grandmother and godmother. My grandmother was a paraplegic, and my godmother was a janitor. So I know communities. I know what, you know, families in low income and, you know, communities have to go through, and I know how difficult it can be to be marginalized by big systems and bureaucracies. So I started this work because I felt a connection to those families, and I wanted to help in some way. And that has been my journey, just, you know, and I won't say on a soapbox, but out really trying to empower people, helping them help themselves learn how to stand up, be it for a child with autism, you know, be it for a change in your community. I met with a group of like 15 moms about a couple of weeks ago about a school. They don't have a middle school in their community that they believe is safe and appropriate for their kids. So, you know, I meet with folks, and I'm like, you know, how do you demand more? How do you hold your school system accountable? Your kids and all the kids in this community have an absolute right to have an appropriate, you know, school that can provide them with a good quality education.
Yeah.
So I'm just a stern believer in, you know, learning to take action and stand up where there's a need.
Yeah, you definitely are a shining example of that, for sure. Do you ever? What's your future hold for you? What are some of your additional goals and dreams?
Well, I'm working on another book project in the Everyday Advocate series, and I'm actually working on some TV projects related to the concept of advocacy. So I just envision continuing, you know, to work with people. You know, that's what I do. That's what I love. I love, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to get to meet so many amazing people and to just use my own personal experiences. Both as a mom, I think I'm in a unique space because, you know, I am a mom, but, you know, I have this technical expertise as a lawyer, and I run a nonprofit organization. So I get to bring all of these various, you know, components together, and, you know, I can use all of those, you know, experiences to really help other people. So that's what I'm most excited about is being able to take my legal background and, you know, take all the access that I have. And you know, I said to these women, you know, call this person and tell them that I said to call you, you know, and not throwing my weight around as much as just saying, you know, I have some resources here and I want to share them with you because I believe in what you're fighting for.
Yeah.
So
now if someone is on, let's say, you know, the East Coast and wants access to you or to maybe grow your special needs network across the country. Are you, we only have 3 minutes left, but are you doing things like that as well? Are you expanding that?
Oh, absolutely. We're doing a lot, like so many organizations, you know, via our website. This class I talked about, the PAM program, this advocacy training, we're looking to launch it this year online so that people across the country can, you know, sign on to our website and get the 18 hours of training via the Internet. We're engaged in going into communities, helping communities establish support groups and advocacy groups, and to continue some of the work that we're doing here in Los Angeles County. So I encourage your listeners to go to specialneedsnetwork.org or they can go to arivamartin.com and, you know, write me an email. I am an avid social media buff, so go on Facebook and, you know, send me a friend request, go to my fan page, go to Twitter and follow me. I try to answer all of my emails, so if someone shoots me an email on Facebook or sends me one through my website, I definitely respond to people. I'm always trying to get people engaged, and on my Facebook page, I carry on a series of conversations about, you know, topics that are happening, you know, daily. So I encourage people to reach out, you know, either through Facebook or Twitter or one of the websites, specialneedsnetwork.org or arivamartin.com.
Okay, well, thank you. I want to thank you guys both for being with us today. Again, we've had the pleasure of speaking with Ariva Martin and Eric Chesson for the past hour to talk about Autism Awareness Month and their various projects. And you can go to autismfitness.com to reach Eric Chesson, or you can go to arivamartin.com to reach Ariva, or specialneedsnetwork.org. You can also pick up a copy of Ariva's book, which is The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism. And I thank you both so much for being with us today. And we will follow up on besteveryou.com and bestevercommunity.com, as well as on our Twitter and our Facebook and all that. And so we'll cover all bases and get you guys promoted and connected with everyone in the Best Ever You Network. So thank you both very, very much for
fantastic. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And did either one of you have anything else that you, we have just a minute left. Is there anything else about Autism Awareness Month that our listeners should know?
Well, I think what everyone should know is that this is a month where we celebrate those living with autism. So wherever you are, you know, get connected, go to a support group, go to a rally, go to a conference. There's so many opportunities to get out and meet other families, connect with other families, and to really, you know, just inspire someone, because there's so much hope now. There's so many opportunities for kids to really thrive.
Thank you
very
much.
Just to build on what Areva said also, you know, Autism Awareness Month is not just about handing out pamphlets and people just getting, you know, the 12 signs of autism. It's about interaction in the community, and that's the only way that we're going to build a successful future for individuals with autism right now and individuals diagnosed, you know, today or tomorrow or next week. So it's really about peer relationships with children and young adults now, and just sponsoring and becoming part of programs that have that socialization component, because that's how we're going to create a successful future for this generation and future generations of all individuals, you know, regardless of diagnosis.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us. We've got to end on that note. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right.